last month for center Darko Milicic, but the Knicks waived Cardinal after the deal to make him a free agent. The 6'8 Cardinal played only a few minutes in 27 games for Minnesota before the trade. The Pacers will try to snap a 9-game road losing streak and get their first season sweep of the Detroit Pistons tonight. The Pacers have won 3 out of 4 and won both games during a brief homestand last weekend. The Hawks have a big game tonight in the NHL. The Blackhawks host the Phoenix Coyotes with first place in the NHL Western Conference on the line. They'll try to avenge Saturday's 5-4 shootout loss to Phoenix, and the Coyotes have won 9 in a row. In a rematch of last year's Stanley Cup final, the Red Wings beat the Penguins last night 3-1. St. Louis Cardinals slugger Albert Pujols could miss a couple days of spring training after getting an anti-inflammatory shot because of tightness in his back. He was scratched from yesterday's game against the Boston Red Sox. The Cardinals are off today. The White Sox and Cubs are both in action in spring training out in Arizona. Their games begin at around 3 o'clock. And that's sports.
Vintage Vinyl is coming up on Saturday, May 8th. Start packing your used CDs, records, DVDs, tapes, and working stereo equipment now. And beginning March 31st, drop them off at any Busey Bank office in Champaign, Urbana, or Savoy. Call Dean Geiken at 217-333-6503 for more information.
We're broadcasting from Campbell Hall for Public Telecommunication, thanks to a generous gift from Allison Robert Campbell. It's 2:41. I'm Tom Rogers in for Celeste Quinn today on the Afternoon Magazine. Google has made good on its threat to stop filtering its search engine in China. Yesterday, Google began redirecting Google users to a search service in Hong Kong, in effect lifting censorship. The move defies Chinese government regulations and could mean the search engine's exit from one of the world's most promising markets. NPR's Lisa Lim reports on the reaction from the streets of Shanghai.
Internet users here are calling it G-Day, the moment of reckoning when Google finally turned words into action. In the early hours of the morning here, Google announced it was shutting its Chinese website and rerouting searches to Hong Kong. Some netizens saluted its bravery. Others aren't so sure.
Maybe it's just a gesture for Google to still have the markets and don't lose face.
Dong Jianguo is an associate professor researching new media at Fudan University. He has little sympathy for Google, which he says should have followed Chinese law.
Google has overestimated its importance to Chinese netizens here. As a researcher and an English-speaking person, I use Google English a lot. But for most Chinese netizens, they don't care about Google Chinese version.
It's true that Google's Chinese language search engine is far behind market leader Baidu, but Google still has around 36% of the market. The official response from China was angry, with this statement on the noon news.
Google has violated the written promise it made on entering the Chinese market. It is totally wrong in halting the filtering of its search provider and in making aspersions and accusations toward China about hacking attacks.
So how does this new arrangement work? Well, if I go to Google's Chinese language search engine, I'm redirected to their Hong Kong site. And if I type in a sensitive term, now let's try Tiananmen Student Movement in Chinese, and then I do a search, I still get a message saying the web page cannot be displayed. And that's because here in China, the filters that stop you from viewing those sites are still in place. The new setup isn't very convenient, says student Xiong Qi, complaining that searches through the Hong Kong website are clumsier. Meanwhile, psychology student Catherine Liu says academics here depend on Google.
If Google moves to Hong Kong, but it is still available, I think it will not affect our lives. But if we have difficulties in connecting it, it will have great effect on our daily life.
The unanswered question is what, if anything, happens next. At the moment, Google's Research and Development Center is still in China. The Gmail service is still operating here, as well as a free music download service that Google runs with a Chinese partner. It's not yet clear whether these will continue to operate or if these too may end up being shuttered as the cost of Google's stand against Chinese censorship. Louisa Lim, NPR News, Shanghai.
Remember that huge blackout in the summer of 2003? 45 million people in the Midwest and Northeast U.S., as well as 10 million people in Canada, lost power. In this story from the Environment Report, Julie Grant reports that the federal government and utilities are spending billions of dollars on what's called a smart grid, in part so we don't have more large-scale blackouts.
Right now, electric power in the U.S. is generated by a relatively small number of very big power plants. That power is transmitted all over the place. But this setup is increasingly running into problems. The demand for power is skyrocketing, from big American houses and TVs, air conditioners and computers. The grid is struggling to keep up, and it's not always succeeding. There have been more and more massive blackouts in recent years than in previous decades. Universities, private laboratories, and utility companies are all looking at different aspects of making the electric grid smarter. Chris Eck is spokesman for First Energy, which provides power in Ohio, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey. He says there are so many ideas on how to improve the nation's electrical system.
Part of the challenge we face is defining the smart grid. I think there are different opinions out there about what it will and won't include.
The Department of Energy says the smart grid will change the electric industry's entire business model. Instead of being a centralized producer-controlled network, it'll transform to become decentralized and consumer interactive. Ken Laparo works on these kinds of issues at Case Western Reserve University in Ohio. He says a smart grid will get consumers more involved in planning their energy use.
Right now, you have no idea of what a kilowatt hour is costing you in Cleveland on March 10th at 8:30 in the evening.
Laparo says most of us just look at those little bars on our electric bills that show how much energy we use that month. But he says it doesn't really mean that much to us. But companies are developing all kinds of products, smart plugs, smart thermostats, smart appliances, that tell you how much energy is being used so customers can decide the best ways to reduce energy use and to reduce their bills. Utility companies might start charging more at peak energy times of day, and they'll communicate those shifting prices to smart consumer devices in real time. Laparo says these small slices of energy savings might not seem like a lot.
But it's the cumulative effect of what everybody is doing, no matter how small it is, that when you add it up over millions and millions of customers over days and weeks and months and years, that the overall opportunity is huge.
But there's still a lot to be done. A decentralized system is going to need better communication. If every programmed refrigerator is constantly trying to optimize its energy usage based on the power's moment-to-moment price, the electricity system will also have to be an information system. Each smart appliance and home meter will have to be able to communicate with the energy companies. If it works, this type of communication could help utility companies predict an overload on the power system, like the one that started the blackout in 2003. Utilities today just predict when usage will be high, but using a smart grid, they'll actually know how high it is in real time. Utilities will also have a better ability to fix problems in the system before they get out of control. This is what some researchers call the holy grail of the smart grid. In the short term, they see consumers learning more about saving energy and communicating that to the power companies. But in the long term, they want to be able to sense and manage the grid to avoid those debilitating blackouts. For the Environment Report, I'm Julie Grant.
State governments often mandate power companies to buy alternative energy. They figure it's worth having everyone buck up and pay extra since these don't contribute carbon dioxide emissions that change the climate. But what energy sources should make the cut? Sean Ali found that one is getting lots of scrutiny.
Bob Cleaves heads up the Biomass Power Association. He spends a lot of time pitching the idea that electricity made by burning wood is worth government help. After all, he can't sell the idea of biomass on price.
Electricity generated from wood had to compete with coal and natural gas, and it became very difficult to operate these plants on a profitable basis.
Cleve says other alternative energy sources are expensive too, but biomass has extra benefits. He says try running solar panels at night. Biomass power plants run 24/7. But Cleves admits he's got explaining to do when it comes to carbon emissions, you know, from burning the wood.
When you burn something, you release CO2.
For years, Cleves would follow up with a simple argument. He'd just run through the carbon cycle idea you might recall from high school. You know, you burn trees, that releases CO2. Then as the trees regrow, they absorb that same carbon again.
These are carbon that is recycled into the environment in a closed-loop fashion.
This argument often won out. Many states give subsidies to biomass power made from wood, since they consider it to be carbon neutral. The U.S. House came close to doing the same thing last year. But lately, biomass's reputation got into trouble.
Well, the carbon issue came up in the fall as a result of an article published in Science magazine.
The title of the article was, quote, "Fixing a Critical Climate Accounting Error." It challenged the idea that biomass power from wood or anything else is always carbon neutral. Critics now use the article's arguments against biomass subsidies.
This policy is intended to reduce carbon emissions, and it's doing the exact opposite.
This is Jana Chickwin, an anti-biomass activist from Massachusetts. She says, sure, trees you cut for power now will grow back and then reabsorb carbon, but not soon.
It will create a pulse of carbon emissions that will spike for decades. Policymakers are telling us that we're in a carbon crisis and that we have to reduce carbon emissions now.
So Chickwin says it makes no sense to subsidize biomass technology.
Those funds should be going to truly valuable contributors to the energy problem, like wind and solar and conservation and efficiency.
Well, Chickwin and other biomass critics won a temporary victory in Massachusetts. The state was leaning towards subsidizing biomass power, but it held off a final decision. It's waiting for advice from an environmental consulting group called ManaMet. President John Hagan says people expect a simple answer. Would a biomass industry in Massachusetts be carbon neutral or not?
So the last thing you want to hear a scientist say is complicated, but I'm afraid it is in this case.
The latest research suggests some biomass power operations can be carbon neutral, while others won't be. The best operations would use tree trimmings or waste wood like sawdust. That keeps more trees in the ground absorbing carbon. Biomass power plants actually prefer to use waste wood anyway, since it's cheap. But Hagan says maybe more biomass plants will all chase the same scrap wood. Prices would rise, and suddenly standing trees start looking cheaper.
It's like a puzzle. And every time you push on one piece, 18 other things move.
Hagan says the bottom line is that biomass can be carbon neutral if subsidies and policies are precise. He says policies should work like scalpels, but often they're really simple and they work more like big axes. For the Environment Report, I'm Sean Ali.
British actor Khalid Abdallah is one of the stars of the new film Green Zone. He plays an Iraqi in the film, marking the third time Abdallah has drawn on his heritage to portray a Middle Eastern character in a Hollywood production. In his next project, Abdallah will do just the opposite, using his footing in Hollywood to make his first independent Arab film. NPR's Bilal Keshi went to Cairo and met Abdallah on the set of his latest film.
In Green Zone, Matt Damon plays an American soldier looking for WMDs in Iraq. He's overseeing a dig in a Baghdad neighborhood when an Iraqi man breaks past the security line to confront him.
You think someone can put something in this place with all these people watching and all these people don't know? It's not logical. I am here to help you, okay?
The role of Freddy, the interpreter, who's here to help, seems fitting for Khalid Abdallah, the actor.
The failure of people to be able to understand things to do with the Middle East is, in some ways, a failure of the arts world.
So the 30-year-old star has tried to guide his career toward changing that. In just 4 years, he's played a hijacker in United 93, an Afghan immigrant in The Kite Runner, and now a conflicted Iraqi in Green Zone. He jokingly calls it his War on Terror trilogy. But just as Abdallah was preparing to film Green Zone, he received an unsolicited script from a first-time director from Egypt. Girlfriend and fellow actor Cressida True urged him to forget it.
It was going to be a huge time commitment with almost no money at all, miles away. I mean, like, in terms of what you would consider to be a sensible, financially oriented, ambitious career decision, this is kind of a little bit left field.
But for Abdallah, it was the rare script that didn't focus on war or politics, but instead on the lives of young artists, not too different from himself, all set on the streets of his parents' hometown.
Anyone who kind of has a filmic sensibility of any kind sort of gets in a taxi or jumps in a car or walks down the street in Cairo and thinks, I wish I had a camera with me.
The film is called In the Last Days of the City, and it tells the story of Bohemian Cairo, Beirut, and Baghdad, of a generation of young artists trying to find their voices in a society that often doesn't see them. It's the story of people like director Tamer Said.
The problem with mainstream cinema is that it undermines me. It doesn't give me my space. It doesn't offer me a solution, and it doesn't give me room to work.
That's because commercial Arab cinema is often a bit like Bollywood, full of slapstick comedy and melodrama.
It's almost like it's impolite to its audience, you know?
So Khalid Abdullah, with his international profile and his experience, joined Saeed to form their own production company. Abdullah raised money in London, Saeed tapped into his personal savings, and they took to the streets to shoot, which, as they've learned, can pose its own problems.
We have the perfect take, and then, you know, the old guy with his cap or whatever, that, you know, he looked so fantastic, looks at the camera and waves at it, and, you know, the whole take is completely ruined.
7 floors above the chaotic streets of downtown Cairo, Cressida True, now part of the film's crew, is logging the day's shoot. That crew is called Zero Productions. Their offices are in an apartment building tucked behind a synagogue in the grand, French-inspired part of the city that was once home to Cairo's intelligentsia. The walls are lined with posters for classic Arab films, and the staff, a mix of Europeans, Lebanese, and Iraqis, are on their MacBooks discussing the day's schedule.
There's loads of different languages being spoken in this office, and loads of different people learning different languages. I mean, you know, there's like hesitant French, hesitant Arabic, hesitant English being spoken all over the place as we all try and speak each other's languages.
Along with learning each other's languages, they're building a new professional network that stretches beyond Egypt. And Khalid Abdullah says their first film is an extension of that spirit.
You know, in the last days of the city, and you say the words Beirut and Baghdad and Cairo and Akhir Ayyam al-Madina, the last days of the city, it kind of resonates a bit for anyone who's lived in Cairo and for anyone who's been through the turmoil and the instability in Lebanon and anyone who's lived in war in Baghdad. It's hard to know whether there's something that ties those instabilities. And I guess part of the question that this film is asking is, what relationship is there between these cities that are finding it hard to keep their balance?
With one foot in the door in Hollywood and the other now trying to kick open a door for Arab filmmakers, Abdullah says he sometimes struggles to find his own balance.
I won't allow either part of me to tell me that I shouldn't love the other part. And I love them both, and I love them both equally. And it saddens me when the people from one part of me don't love the other part of me, and vice versa.
So he hopes In the Last Days of the City will premiere at an international film festival, and that it will help make that connection. And above all, share a story that takes its audience beyond the confines of the Green Zone. Bilal Qureshi, NPR News.
WILL programs are made possible by Women's Health Practice and Dr. Suzanne Troopin, offering obstetrics, gynecology, and fertility services on Neal Street in Champaign. Women's Health Practice is a Health Alliance medical plan provider and is accepting new patients. More information is available at womenshealthpractice.com.
Earth and Sky.
Today we're speaking with Jacob Bloomberg, senior research scientist at NASA Johnson Space Center. He said that astronauts returning from the zero gravity of space often have trouble with balance.
Crew members may have difficulty turning corners, walking straight lines, things that are fairly easy for us to do here on Earth, but are difficult during this period of adaptive change.
Bloomberg said it can take up to 4 weeks for astronauts to adapt to Earth gravity after long space missions. He's working with the National Space Biomedical Research Institute to create a training system to speed up that transition. Astronauts walk on a treadmill with a moving base while watching a projected image that's also moving.
The training system hinges this concept of learning to learn. And what that is you can train the brain to become more adaptable if you're exposed to training that pushes the system in an adaptive way.
In other words, when an astronaut's brain has already been challenged to deal with sensory conflicts, it's more prepared to deal with the transition back to Earth's gravity. Bloomberg said his system could also help people on Earth improve their balance. Our thanks today to the National Space Biomedical Research Institute, innovations for health in space and on Earth. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.